The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture entitled The Close of an Era, The Life and Times of Rav Ashi and His Disciples, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas, Chava Bas Rav Yoel Zussman Oleha Sholem, Mrs. Evelyn Framer, of blessed memory.
Over the last year, we have traced the history of the Amoraim, the great teachers of the Talmud. During this period in the cities of Tzipori, Sepphoris, in Tiberia and Tiberias in Israel, and the cities of Nahardah, Sura, Pumpadisa, and Mechuza in Bovel, in Babylon. The Amoraim, the greatest authorities of Torah, met to discuss, ponder, and argue virtually every point of Jewish law and thought, all that would be finally incorporated into the Talmud. By the year 352, the year of the death of Rava, most of the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, and all of the Talmud Yerushalmi, the teachings of the yeshiva of the city of Tiberias in Israel, had already been composed. In a few short years, in the year 359, the calendar, as we know it today, had been set by the remainder of Torah scholars in Israel under the leadership of Hillel II, Hillel Cotton, the 13th generation of the great family of Hillel the Elder. How the Talmud in its final form actually came into being is the subject of the next lecture of this series. This lecture, however, deals with the lives of the great disciples of Rava, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Rav Papa, and Rav Ashi, the lives of their colleagues and their disciples, the places that they taught, and the time frame in which they lived. These were the Rashi Masifta, the heads of the great yeshivas in Bavel, whose immortal legacy forms the final layer of the Talmud. It is my fervent hope that after hearing these lectures, the masters of the Talmud will no longer remain in your eyes a confusing collection of mere names, but real people who lived in the backdrop of a history and chronology with which you will be intimately familiar. The life of Rava and his city and his yeshiva in Mechuza was the subject of the last lecture. You have it on your notes on the first page. In paragraph A, we quote from the letter of Rav Shriragon. And as we've mentioned many times before, Rav Shriragon, who lived in the 10th century of the Common Era, wrote in letter form to the community in North Africa in Keruan a history of the Torah Shebaal Peh, of the oral law, from its earliest beginnings, says all the way to his lifetime in Babylon. He covers extensively the period of the Talmud and also the period of the Gaonim, the scholars, the heads of the yeshiva that succeeded the masters of the Talmud. In describing the era under discussion tonight, he writes, after the death of Rava, the Masifta was divided into two. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak became Rosh Yeshiva in Pumpadisa for 4 years. He died in the year 356. Rav Papa became Rosh Yeshiva in Nersh, close to Sura, for a period of 19 years. He died in the year 371. And this is taken from the letter of Rav Shriragon. Just to give you a little background to make to appreciate what the significance of what Rav Shrira is writing. Originally, as we've said before, when Rav, this is the great disciple of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, the editor of the Mishnah, when Rav came to Babylon, there was no Masifta in Babylon. Masifta would be the equivalent of a Sanhedrin, a place where all the great scholars would come together and discuss some important issues of Jewish law. What they had was called the Sidra. It was the equivalent of a yeshiva. A yeshiva is you have a great scholar who has disciples. But then those that graduate the yeshiva have their own followings in their respective communities and rarely come together. And this is after they've graduated, they've finished. The yeshiva rarely come together to this cross-fertilization and the give and take, which would create a consensus of opinion. The Masifta that did exist was in Israel, and it was under the leadership of the descendants of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi. When Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi's grandson died, and shortly after that period, there actually became a Masifta in Babylon, and not one, but two. And here, Rav created in southern Babylon, in the city of Sura, not just a yeshiva, he had a yeshiva, but he really had a Masifta, where from time to time, it seems twice a year, all the great scholars would come together from that area. Shmuel, his colleague, had a similar institution, a Masifta, in the north. I mean, there's only some 70 kilometers separating them, but in the north, in Nahar Dor. So you had one group, central group in the south, the other central group in the north. At the same time, the Masifta in Israel was located in Tiberias, in Tveria, under the leadership of Rabbi Yochanan. So here we had three. This existed, the idea of having separate Masiftas in Babylon, until the death of Rav in the year 247. He began circa in the year 230. This Masifta. So for some 17 years, there were two Masiftas. After Rav was Nifter, so everyone, Shmuel, really the Masifta was by Shmuel in the north, in Nahar Dor. There was a small group of scholars who did not move there. I mean, they came there from time to time to be by Shmuel. They basically were located still in Sura. That's where they were under the guidance of Rav, and they still remain there. They were called Bei Rav, the Yeshiva of Rav, under the leadership of Rav Huna, one of the great disciples of Rav. But the Masifta, the conclave of scholars, was now located in Nahar Dor, a single institution. And that lasted for some 6 years until Shmuel died in the year 253. After Shmuel died, it seems there was a gap. I mean, there was a question of where it should be located and who should lead it. We find 4 years later in the year 257 that again we have one central Masifta located in the south in Sura, under the leadership of Rav Huna, who up until that was leading the yeshiva of Rav, and now he was the head of the Masifta. Rav Huna was the Rosh Yeshiva for 40 years. And when he died, his colleague Rav Yehuda became the head of the Masifta, but the Masifta now moved north again. And it was in Pumpadisa, a place close to Nahar Dor. And it was there in Pumpadisa until the death of Abaye in the year 338. In other words, it was there for some almost 40 years in Pumpadisa. At first under Rav Huna, under Rav Yehuda after the death of Rav Huna for 2 years. It was nominally under the leadership, that Masifta of Rabbah after the death of Rav Yehuda. Rabbah did not want to take these. We explained in a previous lecture, he didn't want to take the position. One of the elder scholars of the generation was still alive, Rav Chisda. And even though technically it should have continued on in Pumpadisa, as a matter of fact, the scholars of Pumpadisa went down to Sura and treated, you know, Rav Chisda as if he had the actual title of the head of the Masifta. For 10 years, they went down south. Again, one institution. After Rav Chisda died, Rabbah, who was originally appointed as the head of the Masifta, actually exercised that the role. And again, in his city, Pumpadisa, the north, again, one Masifta. It was until he died in the year 321. Rav Yosef, who was his colleague, became the head of the same Masifta for 2.5 years. When he died, Abaye became the head of the Masifta. So there was all just one Masifta. When Abaye died in the year 338, the leader became Rava. That was the subject of the last lecture. He moved the Masifta to Mechuza. And Mechuza was east. It was by the Tigris. At least it was a different kind of a community. It was outside the mainstream Babylon. Until the time he died, again, there was one central institution. And the value of having a central institution is that it avoids confusion. I mean, afterwards, everyone is coming together, you know, and if you have questions or you have different versions or I learned it this way or you have this opinion, we all come together and discuss it and we develop a consensus. After the death of Rava, the idea of having a single Masifta came to an end. And now we have two. Something which really did not exist only in the days of Rav and Shmuel again came back. So there's over 100 years there was only one central institution. Now there were now two. One in the north and one in the south. The north was under the guidance of Nachum Bar Yitzchak, the south under the guidance of Rav Papa. And Ner, Shripopa's city, was the near Sura, the original center in the south, now became the seat of the southern Masifta. So just to give you appreciate the dynamics of what's happening here. Rav Isaac Halevi, the historian, in the light of the dynamics here, of the movement from one to the next, because you have to, it's something like a floating crap game, you know. I mean, it goes from one to the next, and there's some of the shurim I give at night, you know, that goes from one house to another house to another house. But it still retained its singular purpose and its power as a central body. In other words, we have a very it's a very strange expression we have when we refer to Rav Popper and his colleague Rav Huna Breid of Yeshua on several occasions, which we don't have by others, by other scholars. We have an expression ki osa Rav Popper Rav Huna Breid of Yeshua mebei Rav Pirshua. So there were on various occasions, and you'll find this in paragraph B, says in the various citations, where we have a situation where the Talmud itself discusses something, does not come to a clear resolution. You know, they've discussed it over this generation or that generation, and finally it says when Michi Osir Papa, they came from the yeshiva. This is what they said. That's a little strange, you know. Who do they say it to? Rav Isaac Halevi explains that what it means is when they left the central institution, and there was a breakdown of the central institution, Rav Papa created his own in the south, Rav Nachum created his, Nachum Bar Yitzchak created his own in the north. So when he left Bei Rav, in other words, he left the central body, he left the central yeshiva, and he came to his own yeshiva, and this was the lecture that he gave, and he resolved these problems that were left, unresolved, or not, at least not satisfactorily resolved. This is previously. But the expression is he came from there to here denotes really a change of address, a change of venue. And what it means to say, really just have like a hint to this process, is that there was a period of time that there was a central Bei Rav. This was a central yeshiva. And then he left that yeshiva and made his own. And it was in his own that they made these statements. It was not said in Bei Rav, a central thing, because it no longer existed. There were now two. And what it created by having two is, and in certain times, what created was confusion. Because if once you have two mesiftas, you know, and there is always a difference of recollection and interpretation, we already start having different versions of incidents and statements that were stated before. And here we have in paragraph C, we have an expression again which is not uncommon. Besura omer lo lahai shmaita b'hai lishna. In surah they said this discussion over in this version. In Nahar Da'a, they taught it like this. Really referring because there are different places that the Torah was being taught. We no longer had a central body. They didn't speak to each other. So we have, says, well, in Surah they taught it this way, in Har Da'a they taught it that way. Nahar Da'a was not the seat of the Mesifta, but it was right close to Pumpadisa. And Nahar Da'a had its own Gedolim, had its own great, great scholars and yeshivas. So again, we have now, which is the breakdown of this centrality of scholarship. So, they teach it this way here, and they teach it that way there. It would be some years before, again, they come together. And I just wanted to just, this is just a little background to appreciate what's happening here. We'll get back to this subject again. But just to summarize, from the time of the death of Rav, for over 100 years, there was only one central institution. It may have changed. It may have been Pumpadisa, and Sura, Mechuza, but there was only one. After the death of Rava, now we have two. And basically, for much of the period of the existence of the yeshivas, we find two, not one, but two centers, two mesiftas, all the way to the period of the Gaonim. To the Gaonim we have the mesifta of Sura, the mesifta of Pumpadisa. Again, this duality. It began with the death of Rava. One of the, in terms of Jewish law, one of the major advantages of having a central institution, especially if this is the institution which represents the greatest scholars of Jewish people, is that the decisions are binding upon all Jews. Today, we have a decision by someone, by an Adam Godel, by a person of great stature in Israel, is not necessarily binding for others who have other Rabbanim, you know, who have followed the opinions of other scholars. There's no central masifta. During the period of the Gaonim, this was the case. And it was only, and as we're going to discuss, during the period of Rav Ashi, who, while there were two masiftas, but he was such a towering individual that he managed to bring the scholars of both areas together to make the final decisions and form the Talmud. But aside from the period of the lifetime, a period of the lifetime of Rav Ashi, for what would be the next some 600-700 years, we find two institutions and no one central authority, and therefore really we don't have any one institution whose rulings will be universally binding. Just add, well, before we go further, just to add one interesting point here in the dynamics of how Jewish law is decided. When there was a central Sanhedrin, and there is a discussion amongst the various members, and they voice their opinions, and there's the give and the take, and finally there's the final vote. And the final decision becomes binding. This is a halacha achre rabim lahatos. This is in the what we read in the parsha this week. After the majority, shall we veer? Shall we go? The scales are tipped in favor of the majority. And there's no one after there's a decision of the Sanhedrin. There's no member of the Sanhedrin can go and say, well, I disagree and I will therefore rule differently. However, if we don't have that give and take, it's not a decision made in a central body, but we have a majority of scholars that throughout the world maintain one opinion and a minority maintains another opinion. There's a response of the Rajba that clearly states, that in that case, the opinion of the minority, in a certain sense, is just as valid as that of the majority. Rabbinically, if I don't know what to choose, and I don't know who to go after, then I don't have a Rebbe, and I'm not a member of the yeshiva or the community of the one who has the minority opinion, then it's incumbent upon me to go with the consensus. That's rabbinical guideline what to do when you're in doubt. However, says, for anyone who decides to be or is part of the member of that community of the minority, one has the right to follow his rov. I mean, the more the Asra. I mean, he has the right. He's the one who paskins. He rules, and one has the right to go with his opinion. Again, assuming he is the equal of those who he's disagreeing with. I mean, he is capable of holding his own, so to speak, because since it was not decided in the central body, the minority opinion is an opinion. And if I'm a member of his community, I have the right to follow my Rav's opinion, even though it's a minority. And he has the right to express that opinion. Only, A, he says, if I'm not a member of any community, what should I do? There is a rabbinic decision, Yochad v'rabim halacha k'rabim. If you don't know what to do and you're not a member of it, what should you do? It's not the Torah law of acharabim lahatos, the one tips the scale of the rule after the majority, but rather it's a ruling for all those who are not part of one community or another. It says you go after the consensus. So you don't know what to do. You see, what are the majority of poskim, what are the majority of the sizers maintain? That's what you should go there, because you don't have a rover. You're not connected to it. If there is a central authority, though, then the decisions, assuming, have been gone through, and they've come through a vote, there's a final consensus. That consensus is binding upon all. So here's the advantage, having a central body versus disparate bodies. During the period when the community in Israel was still extant, and there were great scholars in Israel, even when there was a central body in Babylon, it still was not the only body of Jewish scholarship, because you had the ones in Eretz Yisrael, in Palestine, Israel. But during the period that we're speaking of now, we're starting now from the year 352, there was very little left of the community in Israel. Because of the rise of Christianity and the terrible persecution there, the scholars were not able to function as a central body, and many of them, as we'll see, left because of the pressure. So during this period under discussion, there was not much in Israel. As we discussed before, says, and this is really in the we mentioned in passing, in the year 359 would be the vestiges of the scholars of Israel came together and created the calendar that we use today under the leadership of Hillel HaKotan. We do not hear after this date much of the community of scholars in Israel. So, for all extensive purposes now, we no longer have two communities, we just have one. But they are a divided community. So it's really, even though it's been, in a sense, it's ironic. Even though there's been one community in Babylon for over 100 years, but actually it was one of two, because they had a community in Israel. By the time the community Israel no longer was, the community of scholars in Israel was no longer functioning. So now it says you have one in Babylon. Babylon now divided itself into two. So again, we do not have one central institution. Before we go further, I'd just like to give you a slight insight into the uniqueness of the scholars under discussion here. The one who led the Masifta in the south was Rav Popa. Rav Popa, it goes without saying, the one who's going to become the leader of a Masifta is a person who's head and shoulders above the rest. He was before the period of Abaye and Rava. They were already students of Rav Yosef. In other words, they were elder scholars. But there's certain details in their life which really sheds light into areas beyond their own particular lives. And in page 2, in paragraph 2, in paragraph B, the Talmud makes the point in Brachos and Nunhei Amud Aleph in 55a that before a leader is appointed, this is Hashem himself announces, prepares us. makes the announcement that this leader will be chosen, in the sense that it doesn't come as a surprise. And in that light, one will understand the idea of prophetic dreams. On several occasions, and this is, there's a, the Talmud in Daf Nun Zion, this is in 57a, deals in the Talmud, in a page or two before as well, deals with the notion of prophetic dreams. One area of dreams, which you're all familiar, which the Talmud discusses as well, is a Marin Lo Belayelah Selamasha Maharaboy Bayom. A person is not shown in a dream, only his thoughts of the daytime. And much of what we dream is really that which we conjure up. It's the product of our imagination, it's the product of events that we somehow through our subconscious we form and transform into something which comes up in our dreams. And this is the area of dreams that those who study dreams deal with. What messages are there? What are the thoughts? Or this is the subtle thoughts. What's in your subconscious that doesn't come before, that are normally suppressed, that are coming out in dream form? And this is the those who interpret dreams go with this approach. Besides this, though, the Talmud speaks of the idea of prophetic dreams, that a dream can be at times a message from the other world. And it takes, very often, it's very subtle. And it takes symbolic form. And in that form, the Talmud relates to the Rav Papa, before he became the head of the Masifta, had such a dream. And you could read into the details of the dream, but what's important is that that leadership is such an important commodity, and this is something we've discussed before. The Talmud says that even a minor official, someone who is the caretaker of water distribution, you know, in an agricultural society, is appointed by heaven. But there are times, at least, that a leader gets some sort of a warning to prepare himself for that position. As I say, a leadership is a tremendous responsibility. So many people tried with all their power to avoid leadership. Here they were told beforehand, this is the story of Rav Papa and Rav Huna Brei Yeshua, who had a position in Rav Papa's yeshiva, were told beforehand about this position. Evidently, it's a sign that I'm telling you what's going to happen. Prepare for it. Another area, again, which goes beyond this, their own particular lives, but we find it in their lives, is something which is. Which is very common, heads of yeshivas, of Hasidic rebbes, of rebbeim, the head of Hasidic dynasties. A leader, through his personality, creates a certain loyalty, has a certain following. People that are close, people confide in him. People that find special qualities in that leader that enables their lives to go on a certain path. When that leader dies and his successor comes, very often they find those who know the greatness of the previous Rosh Yeshiva, Rebbe, find the new one wanting, is lacking. How does he come to the old Rebbe, to the old Rosh Hashiva? I can't even respect him. I remember him when, or you know what he says, ah, if the old one would have said, been here, he would have said it so much better. And very often, and I know this is from my own experience, very often the old Rosh Hashiva, you know, the Talmidim, the disciples of the old Rosh Hashiva, are really asked to leave when the new one comes. Because ultimately they create a lot of trouble for the new person. The new person needs his own following. He doesn't need the holdovers of the last administration. It's basically just the same thing. You get a Republican president, and the whole bureaucracy is Democrats. You can't do anything. You know, anything you want to do, there's no cooperation. We find a similar situation in the life of Rav Papa, which makes it a. And we'll see, says, what did Rav Papa do? How did he deal with that situation? Here, on page 2 in paragraph C, it says the story, this is taken from the Gemara in Tainus and Daf Tes, 9a. Rav Huna bar Manoah from Shmuel bar Idi, Rav Chia of Astanya, used to attend the discourses, the shiurim of Rava. They were Talmidim, they were disciples of Rava. When Rava died, they came to Rav Papa. Again, as we said before, it was divided into two. And they went to the shiurim of Rav Papa. But what he said didn't appeal to them. And they started making gestures, making hints at another. In other words, like looking at each other, and Rav Papa was greatly hurt. And again, these were great people themselves, but evidently they had this tremendous disappointment in this new leader. In a dream. Rav Papa had a dream. Before we quoted that Rav Papa had a dream, a symbolic dream, before he became the head of the Masifta. Here, this is, he had another dream, and here a verse came. He said, I will cut off the three shepherds. There's a pasuk in Zechariah says that I will cut off the three shepherds. Says, when next day these disciples took leave of him, he said to them, go in peace. The Marsha explains, the expression here is Lech Bisholom, which is Lezel Bisholma, which is the expression which is said to someone who dies. And what he saw in the dream was that because they had because of the hurt that they had done to him, that they would, that their life was now coming to an end. Rav Papa didn't do anything. Rav Papa just bared the dissatisfaction. And Hashem took care of him. The next situation was with another colleague of Rav Papa's, Rav Shimi bar Ashi. Here, Rav Shimi bar Ashi did not make any gestures. Shimi bar Ashi wasn't punished, so to speak, for demeaning Rav Papa. But he gave Rav Papa a terrible time. And he asked to ask them much questions. Evidently, had Rava been alive, Rava would have been able to answer these questions. Rav Papa, though, was more of a colleague of his than a teacher. And one day he observed where Rav Papa fell on his face, and he was saying Tachnun after davening. He put his head down, and he heard him saying, and he said, Rachmona litzlomi kisufa deshimi. May God preserve me from the insolence or the embarrassment of Shimi. He He heard him, overheard him say, Hashem says, you know, I just can't take this. Rav Shimi got the message. He was quiet. It didn't bother him anymore. But again, which is just, it hits home, you know, these stories, is that really this is just so common. Rav Papa didn't lash out, you know. Rav Papa took it, and Baruch Hashem, things worked out. Rav Papa had a very interesting life. Even though he was originally seems poor, he became very wealthy. And it was through business. He manufactured and sold beer. Beer was the common beverage. Beer, which made out of dates, was the common beverage in Babylon. It was a poor country. They had, as the Talmud says, the Gemara in Tainus and Choftes Amud Beis in 29b, they had an abundance of flax in Babylon and an abundance of dates, date palms. And therefore it was possible for those people, even the poorest of people, to be clothed and minimally fed. And here, says Rav Papa, made a fortune through manufacturing beer. And an interesting thing we see in the life of Rav Papa, and we see in others as well, as I just share with you this from Rav Papa, is the practical wisdom that many of the sages of the Talmud had. I'm not speaking about the great wisdom of Torah, but in terms of able to advise whole generations practically. And here we have in the top of page 3, Rav Papa said, this is who's giving advice, and this was recorded in the Talmud. So, in other words, but do not buy. He says it would be best, he says, to produce your own if you have a small plot of land, and that's to be self-sufficient in a society that was possible. Even if the cost is the same as in terms of your buying on the market, but you never know what will happen. So people will corner the market. Always have something of your own. There's a blessing in the former. It's yours. And there's a bracha, says, that comes, who knows what will be produced. You're creating a situation with being blessed. And he says, sell out. He says, if you need, you're desperate for money. He says like this, He says, sell out to avoid disgrace. And if you're forced to it, so it's better to sell your, in other words, instead of being a recipient of charity, sell your belongings. But sell something that you could get back, I guess, on the market when your fortunes are again come back. But something that you're sure you can always get, you can, you need the money now, hopefully be able to invest it and get your money, as we're speaking about, you're desperate now, you can sell, but make only sell something you can get back. This is not your cloak. Evidently, again, before the society says, not necessarily you'll find a suitable one, evidently they're tailor-made, says, not necessarily you'll find the right one again. Further on, and he says about, says when your house is disrepair, says keep on maintaining your house, says, you know, in a proper thing, because don't wait till it totally goes to disarray. Says better keep on repairing what you have than rebuilding a whole new one. Says be quick in buying land, but be deliberate in taking a wife. He says, land, okay, says Muslims in the Sivitzah, says, be very deliberate in taking a wife. says, come down a step in choosing your wife. He says, which is Rashi explains the dynamics of a home being that there has to be a bias for respect of the wife to respect the husband. It's best to go down, and as your wife in terms of in a society that was, it's a little difficult for us to appreciate all the nuances of this, because in a certain sense the democratic society in America is such that it's largely, or at least much less so than it was in Europe, a classless. Notice you don't have a clear divisions of class that you had in other societies. In other societies you wouldn't, you know, you just marry within your social circle. You wouldn't go up, you wouldn't go down, you just remain within the social circle. He says it's best to go down. Because when you go down, there's a bias for your wife to respect you. You know, you happen to be on a different social status, in a different caste, so to speak, in a different class. Your wife will respect you. There's a... Well, I saw a commentary in this week's Sedra, last week's Sedra. In the Medrash, the receiving of the Torah is described in terms of a wedding. It's the wedding of Hashem and the Jewish people. There are certain, in fact, there are certain even references to this, or parallels to the receiving of the Torah and a wedding. You know, the formula for the marriage has Hariat Mukadeshusli. Behold, you're betrothed to me. It starts with Hey. There are five books of the Torah. The Ksuba starts with the letter Beis. Becha b'Shabbos, B'Sheni b'Shabbos. Starts with Beis. The Torah starts with Beis. Bereishis. There is a Medrash. I mean, this is where the Gemara brings this down, and Shabbos and Peches Amad Aleph, and 88a, and the Gemara Navoi Dezora, and Beis on Beis, and 2b. Says that by Matan Torah says, Kofalam Har Kigigis, that the mountain rose up like a big vat over their heads. One of the commentaries explains that was the chuppah. There was this whole... and there was this marriage ceremony. The kasuba was the Aseres Hadibros, was the Ten Commandments. When Hashem went down, it says, V'yered Hashem al Sinai, says he went down on the mountain, the cantillation, the trup, is Darga Tavir. Darga Tavir literally means the steps are broken, like Darga, the levels are broken. He says, V'yered Hashem al Sinai, Hashem went down. Says Hashem also, when he picked a wife, went down a step. This is Darga Tavir. This all comes from the advice of, but go up a step in selecting your shushbin. The shushbin are the, we close to be the best man, as the ones, the friends of the groom. It says, pick friends a level above you. You can learn from your friends. So when you pick your friends, it should be a notch above. And again, it's from class wise. There's another incident in the life of Rav Popa, which again, on a totally different, you know, up until here we dealt with his in terms of becoming a leader while he was a leader. We dealt with the practical advice that he had, and it's really noteworthy that it was preserved in the Talmud. I felt this is, you know, this is part of the Derech Eretz. This is part of the worldly wisdom that's important to know. There is a near-death incident which is recorded in the Talmud. It's an out-of-body experience. Rav Huna Breder Yeshua, the son of Rav Yeshua, was the colleague of Rav Papa. And he was once very ill and became comatose. Rav Huna recovered. And Rav Papa, speaking to him, and here is on page 3 in paragraph E, he was anxious to see him, and he said, and evidently he realized that he was close to death's door. His body, his consciousness, his ruach had left his body. He says, "What did you see in your illness?" He says, "You know, it's as indeed as you thought. The Holy One says, my soul, my conscience left the body." Says, but Hashem said to the angels, because he does not insist upon his rights, he's Mavar al Midosav, do not be particular with him. Says, you know, says, he's a person who forgives others, you know, we'll forgive him as well. And we're going to give him a new lease on life. Because he was a giving person in his life, we will be in turn giving to him. And this is one of the few near-death experiences which are recorded in the Talmud. He really had an out-of-body experience, and he went to the other world. And he was told to go, normally, at least those who interview, are told to go back because your time has not come. Here he was told to go back because you're given extra time, which is noteworthy. So I just, again, wanted just to give you a little glimpse into the personal life of Rav Papa. I'd like to now touch upon a glimpse in the life of Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, who became, again, the head of the Masifta in the north in Pumbedisa. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak seemed was older than Rav Papa. He was more like a colleague rather than a student of Rava's. He studied by Rava. He was studied by Rav Nachman, studied by Rav Chiya Bar Oven. He studied by Rav Yosef. He was really of the generation of Rava and Abaye more than the others. A very interesting incident in his life. The Gemara makes the point. There's a Gemara in Shabbos. This Kufnun Vav 156b, A and B, that ain mazal li Yisrael. Before a person is born, his life is mapped out. How long he will live, how many children he will have, what will be of him, what kind of a living he will make. For a Jew, it's possible that that mazel, in other words, that which has been initially determined for his life can be changed. And the Gemara brings various incidents to prove this. And one of this, the idea that a person can change, or what's destined can change, is from the life of Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. And here on top of page 4, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak's mother was told by astrologers, your son will be a thief. So she did not let him be bareheaded. She said, cover your head so that the fear of heaven may be upon you, and pray for mercy. So she told the little child, this is the sort, you know, this is, we call a head covering a yarmulke. It's a yore malka. It's the fear of the king. So this is one of the sources. She didn't know what she meant, says, but one time he was sitting and studying under a palm tree, and it fell off. You know, his yarmulke fell off, and he was sitting under a palm tree. And he didn't have that symbol anymore. And he saw that it was a private tree, and he climbed up and bit off a cluster of dates with his teeth. In other words, he had that the predisposition to be a thief, but it was being controlled. Eventually, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, besides his great scholarship, was also known, as we have in page D, as Moreh D'Uvda. Says he was the He was most particular in the practice of halacha, a rare title. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, and this is something we'll discuss in the next lecture, had also a very unique position amongst the Talmudic scholars. Throughout the Talmud, we have him being what would be the expert of text. Whenever there's a question of a text, whether it be in the Torah itself, whether it be in the Talmud, he is the expert. And here we have a very, just quickly, there's a question about, and this is just one example, if a word written in the Torah is mole or chaser, those if it's written with a vav or without a vav, sometimes with a yud or without a yud, which doesn't significantly change the pronunciation, but he was the expert. And as I'm explaining, he was the one who knew. In terms of the correct text of the Talmud, again, in various, this we brought in paragraph B, one of them, again, what is the correct reading of the Mishnah? And we don't find this by others, only by Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. When it comes to quoting, who was the author of a certain statement in the Talmud? It's Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak who says, well, it was this one and not that one. And when it comes to, I suppose uniquely, when it comes to remember, this who was the one who said, which statements, and to avoid confusion, he is the one who offers some mnemonic device to remember, is to keep it all in order. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak refers to himself, says, as Gemarna v'Sadarna, no, I'm a teacher and a systemizer of traditions. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak was in the yeshiva of Rava, as we said before, much of the Talmud that we have took its form from the time of Rava. And Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, it seems, role was in the systemization of the Talmud and making sure that as it's passed on to the next generation, it's passed on in its proper form. What makes this unique is that the Talmud is full of statements, but it's rare to find someone like Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak who's so persistent, saying, "No, this is the way it's to be read, and not the other way," because it seems this was his position. He had this unique function. This is what we're going to explain, because much of the Talmud took its form during his lifetime. And it was he, who was, it seems, the one whose position was to make sure that as it's passed on, that this is the correct version. After Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, and as you will see, we have there's a whole list. This is from the letter of Rav Shrira going. It's on page 5, section 5, of all the successors as heads of the Masifta. And those who are familiar in the Talmud, these are familiar names: Rav Chama, Rav Zvid, Rav Dimi of Nahardo, Rafram, Rav Kahana, Rav Acha Bar Rava. And here we have a list, and as we have as well as in the timeline at the end, this is a list of when they had their positions. This is in Pumpadis, in the yeshiva in the north. In the yeshiva of the south, we have now, in turn, page 6, we have after the death of Rav Papa, again, he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Nerish, which is in the south. We have another Masifta that arises in the south. It reminds you, the south shall rise again. And this was not in Nersh, but in Mosa Machasya. Let me just give you a sense of what Mosa Machasya was. The cities of Nersh, not a major city, but is mentioned, even by Rav, was close to Sura. Mosa Machasya, the Gemara describes here in page 6 in paragraph B, was not a large city, nor was it a village. It was a medium-sized city, but it was a poor city. Rav Mesharsha, he was a disciple of Rava, who sent his son to learn in Mosa Machasya, namely under the direction of Rav Ashi. And we give you a sense of what of a city it was. And he told him, and this is towards the end of page 6 here, paragraph C, rather sit on the rubbish heap of Mosa Machasya than the palaces of Pumpadisa. Rather eat the unsavory gildana, it's a variety of small fish, of Mosa Machasya than the kutach, this was a condiment of the lofty mansions. Mosa Machasya is a poor city. It couldn't compare to Pumpadisa. There were two sites of Torah. One was Pumpadisa, and as we said, this is the last. This became again back a center of Torah after the death of Rava, under Nachum Bar Yitzchok, and we went through those who succeeded him. Rapapa began in the south, the Masifta. It moved to Mosa Machasya. He directed, be there, even though it's not the physical conditions are not the best. But again, it gives you the sense of what kind of a place it was. We see, just from this on page 7, again, much you have to do detective work. The Torah, the Gemara describes at length Sura, speaks about Sura. The people who lived in Babylon, of course, knew where Sura was. We don't. Rav Shmuel Gaon makes the point, is on page 7, paragraph E, Mosa Machasya, this small city, was near Sura, was adjacent to Sura, or like Oak Park to Detroit or Southfield, was adjacent to it. We know on paragraph D on page 7 that it bordered the Euphrates. So at least that much through detective work, we know that it was really in the south, and it was by the Euphrates. It seems Pumpadisa, which was near Nahar Do, was also near the Euphrates. Mechuza, which was the subject of the last lecture, was by the Chideko, by the Tigris. As we... going back to the theme that we went through, one Masifta to two Masiftas, under Rav Ashi, even though there were two Masiftas, the one in Pumpadisa became subservient to that of Mosa Machasya. The north became subservient to the south, and Rav Ashi really became, in his time, the acclaimed leader. This is something, again, that we're going to discuss further as we're going to next week's, the next lecture is about how the Talmud itself was created. Rav Ashi was unique, as we're going to say, in that he studied, he quotes all the greats of the previous generation. In other words, seems to have been very young when Rava passed away. But he studied, it seems, this is the point Rav Isaac HaLevi makes, and it seems from the Rambam, he studied from Rava as well as the others who followed Rava. One unique thing is, as we've quoted this before, this is on page 7, in section 7, paragraph A, it discussed the chain of leadership of the great luminaries of the Jewish people, that before one died, another was born, another came into being. Before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, before Rabbi Akiva died, Rabbi Akiva HaNasi was born. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was born. Before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi died, Rav Yehuda, who again is the Rosh Hashiva in Pumpadisa, was born. Before Rav Yehuda died, Rava was born. Before Rava died, Rav Ashi was born. They looked at these were, in a sense, Rav Ashi in his generation, like was Rabbi Akiva in his. I just quote, and you just look at yourself on pages 8 and 9. These were the greats of that generation that are quoted. These were the generation after Rava. He spoke to Rav, he spoke to Marzutra. There are two Marzutras, by the way. There was one Marzutra which was, it seemed to be, was a disciple of Rav, and there was a Marzutra that was more close to the age of Ravashi. He spoke, it seems he had a discussion with Rav Isaac Halevi, learns with Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchok, he had with Rav Papa. Says Rav Papa told me, quotes Rav Papa, he quotes Rav Papi, another colleague of Rav Papa. And it goes on, Rav Ula, Rav Matana, Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana, it seems, was one of his major influences of his life, one of the great of his Rebbeim. And also Amemar seems to have been younger, and eventually his relationship with Amemar was one of a colleague rather than that of a student. Originally, he was a student of Amemar's. Another colleague of his was Rav Huna Bar Nosson. Rav Huna Bar Nosson became Reish Galusa, the head of the. And there's a fascinating story, which we'll touch upon in the last lecture of the series, that he was highly regarded by the king of Persia, this Rav Huna Bar Nosson. It seems, and this is a point that the Rav Shura Gaon makes, as we said before, Mosul Machasi was a poor city. It was a mid-sized town. It was not very large. It seems to be quite poor. When Ravashi wanted to make this a central place of Torah, he needed the facilities. And there was a shul that was in disrepair. And he made sure, that it would not, he moved his bed into the shul. He says, I'm not moving out until the repairs are finished. And it seems that this shul was the site of his yeshiva. It reminds us of this very fascinating story with Rabbi Saul Salanter. Rabbi Saul Salanter was the founder of the Musar movement, one of the great luminaries of his generation, 150 years ago. There was a story that in a particular town, there was a place for wayfarers, for the poor who used to go through. It was called a Hegdish. It was a place which is designated for the poor. In Yiddish terminology, when you see a house and it's a terrible mess, a kuktos via hegdish, and it looks like this terrible, because the hegdish was poorly kept up, and he felt it was a terrible mark on the community that it was in such a level of disrepair. And Rishol moved into the hegdish. He says, again, I'm not moving out until repairs are made. I just recently studied, also there's a parallel incident, a little different. In the city of Brisk, there was once a fire that destroyed the city. And the people were forced to be in terrible conditions. Again, there were people of wealth, but there were people who were destitute and had to be in the shul, whatever it is, wherever they slept them, and they had to sleep on the floor. Rav Chaim, who was the Rav of the city, felt, how could he sleep in a bed? This is when all these poor people are sleeping on the floor. And he went with them and slept in their conditions until everyone was settled. He was very beloved by the townspeople of Brisk. In fact, they call it, you just get to see a picture of someone in Brisk. It's very critical. And the people of Brisk used to call him Reb Chaimke, with great love and admiration. Rav Ashi moved into the shul, says, I'm not moving out. The repairs were made. But he was a humble person. He didn't take it. We know, just again, these are just some little incidents. Because Rav Ashi basically was most of what was remained after Rava was put together by Rav Ashi, or under his guidance, there is very little about the life of Rav Ashi himself. He's not going to talk about himself. The others, we have great incidents about their lives. But Rav Ashi himself, as we have to piece together anything that we know. The one interesting thing that was made about Rav Ashi was when there were any halachic decisions, he didn't rely on his own. Even though he was a master of the Talmud, he used to bring 10 ritual slaughters. If there was a question, to sit down. He says, in order, says that a chip of the beam, in other words, the whole beam shouldn't fall on my head. If I'm making a mistake, that it should be a portion. Everyone should get a little of the responsibility. We should make a joint decision. Again, it just gives you a sense of again, from a small incident, because we don't know that much about him, you know, as a person, because he didn't write about himself, and his disciples wrote very little. Like Rav Papa before, Rav Ashi had a prophetic dream. This is on page 11. He also had some sort of a warning sound to prepare him for his role as leader. What makes, besides his greatness, and we're dealing with great people here, but it seems that because of the role that he was to play, we only find three people in history that had a similar role. The Talmud makes the statement here, we quote part of that on page 11, paragraph B. It's from a Gemara in Gittin on Tesomad Aleph from 59a. In Moses' times, in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, there was no one equal to him in both material wealth and knowledge of Torah. There was no one like Moshe. And he was basically, through him came the Torah. There was no one like him until the time of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, Yehuda the prince. Where also we have the embodiment, one man, the most powerful political person, and the greatest authority of Torah. Because through him, the Mishnah took its form. The third person was Rav Ashi. Again, recognized by all of his generation as the supreme expert of Torah, and also the man whom they all respected, and this is the wealthiest of his generation. And even Rav Huna Bar Nosson, who was the Reish Galusa, a man of extreme wealth, that the exilarch, the Jewish king, was subservient to Rav Ashi. He needed all that prestige in order to be the leader of that convocation, that group of Rav scholars that would put the Talmud in its final form. And they would all agree under his auspices. He put them all together. They all agree. So finally, after his time, we had the Talmud basically speaks in a single voice. And those decisions were universally accepted. And it was a gift of heaven. The Talmud, and again, this is something we have to discuss next time. When we speak of the composition of the Talmud under Rav Ashi, what we are dealing with is actually two separate events. During the lifetime of the heads of the Masifta, it seems the previous heads of the Masifta, Rav Ashi, and all those that followed way into the times of the Gaonim, including the light in the Rav Shrira Gaon, the Talmud was studied through a system of every half year a tractate was studied. Like the semester was a 5-month semester, so to speak. 4 months was in preparation, they learned through the Masechta. On the 5th month, all the Rosh Yeshivas, all the heads of the various yeshivas, all of their students, all came together, and it was relearned under the head of the Masechta. In some 30-some years, the whole, all the Mishnayos, all the tractates were covered. Rav Ashi lived for almost 60 years in his lifetime. There were approximately 2 cycles. That was one way the Talmud was learned. It seems apart from that, though, because then there were actually, in that sense, there were two masiftas. There were actually two parallel institutions. I mean, when it happened, when they came together in Sura in the south, there was one going on at the same time in Pompidisa in the north. Besides that, though, it seems the Rav Ashi worked with the great leaders of that generation, including the leaders of Pompidisa, during the 4 months, not the 5th month, to put the Talmud, to reorganize the Talmud in a way that will be preserved for all times. The Talmud as we have this, and it seems, does not cover all 60 tractates, but only some 30 tractates. And all the information that was studied in these half-year cycles was all concentrated into these 30 tractates. We have no tractates on the, except for brachos in the Seder, in the order of Zeroyim, of seeds, of planting. We have no tractates. There's the Yerushalmi, they studied in the Shivas, and it was studied in Babylon too. But as a tractate that was left for all generations, it seems Rav Ashi didn't create it. The Talmud was not necessarily, as we have it, not necessarily a picture of what was studied through these half-year cycles. And much of the information of Zeroyim, or the was the impertinent, was put, was interspersed with the teachings of the other tractates. The same thing applies for Taurus, for the thing of ritual purity. Except for the tractate Nida, there we have no Talmud on the tractates of Taurus. But the pages of the Talmud are full of quotations from all these various tractates. So to enable that in a much concentrated form, much abbreviated, that much of the at least essential knowledge would be preserved. So creating this form of the Talmud seems to have been apart from the regular 30-year cycles. And this Rav Ashi worked together with his colleagues to create this final form of the Talmud. And this is, again, something we will discuss in the following lecture. Just briefly, says before we end this class, a fascinating thing. Twice a year they came to Moshe Machasia, all the great Rosh Yeshivas of the South, at least, their disciples. Moshe Machasia, it seems, was not just a Jewish town. There were non-Jews there. He decries as the B'nai Moshe Machasia, the people of Moshe Machasia, the non-Jews, are avirei lev, they're stout-hearted. Because the Chozi Yikor Daraisa Tre Zimni B'Shat, they see the glory of the Torah twice a year. And the question means just literally because they see all the great spiritual giants of the generation. Tosfos brings an explanation that actually there was this aura, this cloud of fire that came. But never one of them has been converted. It would seem that the norm is that it should have made an impression on them. The author of the Torah Tamima writes about his years in... He has a Sefer Makor Boruch, and he writes about the years that he was with his uncle, the Netziv, the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. And he asked him, you know, it seems that what would seem normal is that the yeshiva should have had an impression on the residents. Because it's funny, in the yeshiva of Volozhin, we also have a similar situation. That it doesn't seem that the Volozhin was the, in that time, it closed a little over 100 years ago, but in its time was the central yeshiva of Eastern Europe, at least of Lithuania, Russia, Poland. And yet, he says, it doesn't seem to have made a strong impression on the townspeople. He says, you know, why not? So I believe the Netziv says, the Rav Ashi expect at least when they come twice a year, you know, it makes an impression. But if you see them day in and day out, for sure it doesn't make an impression. You know? It's like and he brings like a story, says that they were dedicating a Sefer Torah, you know, a shul, so, and everyone is kissing it, and it's a whole thing, except a little girl on the side. He says, what's wrong? Why aren't you kissing the Sefer Torah? He says, if I had to kiss Sefer Torahs, I'd be busy, my lips would wear out. I'd be busy kissing all day. He says, my father's a scribe. I see it all day. He says, you take it for granted. But twice a year, at least he felt that's something that they should have, you know, if you don't see it that often, it should make an impression, but evidently it didn't. Rav Ashi had a colleague, Ravina, which time doesn't let us deal with at length. But it was together with Ravina that the Talmud took its final form, which we will discuss in an upcoming lecture. I'd just like to end with the following incident. Rav Ashi had a son. His name was Rav Tav Yumi. But he was called Mar, the master, the son of Rav Ashi. And the Talmud makes the point, and he did not become Rosh Yeshiva after his father's death. The Talmud makes the point that prophecy came to an end during the beginning of the Second Temple. But there are, even though they're not formal prophets, there are people that are gifted that do have extrasensory perception. And these are, but he says, the Talmud is, but these are people, says, that are not people of strong minds. Says either they're fools, children, people that are naive, that they have an idea that maybe they're too thing to suppress it or to, and they say it. And one of the cases is the case of Mar Rav Ashi. We'll read this thing as a fascinating story. He was one day, this is the bottom of page 13, he was one day standing in the marketplace of Mechuza when he heard a certain lunatic exclaim, the man who is to be elected head of the academy in Mosse Machasia signs his name Tav Yumi. This lunatic didn't know him. He just said it. Evidently he had this spurt of inspiration. Mar Rav Ashi says, that's funny, that's my name. He never thought himself, he was a humble, but he didn't think of himself as he should take the position of the head of the Masifna. But evidently, maybe this is a sign from heaven. I should seize the opportunity. He was in Mechuza. Again, Mechuza was by the Chidekel, by the Tigris. He went to Mosse Machasia, he says, was by the Euphrates. When he arrived, he found that the rabbis had appointed Rav Acha of Difti as their head. Rav Acha was also one of the greats of that generation. And as Rav Isaac Halevi pointed out, the reason they appointed him as head because Marbra was not even in the running. You know, he was out there in Mechuza. He didn't look at himself as, he didn't want the position. But when they heard of his arrival, they sent a couple of rabbis to him to consult him, even though he didn't want the position, but he was, again, one of the towering giants of that generation. And they wanted at least to formalize that they wanted his approval. So they came to him, and he detained them. He kept them. He didn't send them out. They're stam schmoozing. The other rabbis who were busy, they want to, you know, to wrap this up here. You know, if you're like, it's one down, let's say it says it's a house down the block, and you have this whole group of rabbis, and they just want, this is a formality, just to seek Mar Rav Ashi's approval. They didn't, you know, they didn't have the, let's say, the gall, the chutzpah to call him to come to them, so they sent two rabbis to Marv Rav Ashi's house. They're not coming back. It was just a formality. So something must happen. Sent another two group of rabbis. He kept them there in his own house. Yeah, you know, gave them tea and cake. He says, no rush. And it kept on until there was finally, there were 10 rabbis who came to Marv Rav Ashi. They're all in the house. When 10, he says, you know what? Because I've decided to take the position myself. And when he said they were not, evidently they felt would be superior or whatever to the other choice, but they, he wasn't even in the running. He began to give a shiur. He expounded the oral law and scriptures. Says, and he felt as this is the only way he'll begin, you know, says that there's not ten, there's not a shiur. You know, so that's why I wait a little bit here until we start. And that's how Marv Rav Ashi became the head of the Masifta. As he heard this thing and he figured he had, evidently he never thought of himself, you know, as having, even though he was a person of tremendous stature. But he felt it was a sign of heaven and he took the things in his hand. He didn't want to go directly to, but he roundabout, and that's how he became the head of the Masifta. Emirat Hashem, this is the eighth of this year's 10 lectures. The next lecture in 2 weeks, we will deal with how the Talmud itself was composed. From the very early beginnings of the oral law, the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, all the way to the end of the Talmud and how it came to its final form. The very last lecture, the following lecture after that, we'll deal with the Rabbonin Savaroi, the scholars that came after, immediately after the scholars of the Talmud, those who put it into their very last form. In other words, just that perhaps maybe less than 1% of the Talmud is from them, or even less than that, but the very final form of what we have today is from them. We will their lives and the political situation that existed in their their times, which led to the period of the Gaonim. Okay, good talk. Are there any questions? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
He went ahead and took that as a sign, and it turned out to be the wrong decision on his part.
The question was about, you know, about interpreting signs here. We said, but I took the sign, and Marv Rav Ashi seized the opportunity. We find another parallel of Yerovam ben Nevat. Actually, he was told by the prophet, Chia Shiloini, to take the position of leadership. And that itself, it seems, was not a wrong decision. Taking the position in that juncture of history was not wrong. We're always given free will. He misused his power. And what he did to cement his power, he created basically a whole new religion, or a slight variation of the original religion, created the cult of the golden calves, to ensure to cement his political power. That was a decision he made subsequent to his appointment. But at the time that he was appointed, he was a person fit for that position. So it wasn't that he misinterpreted the sign. We're always given choices, and subsequent to that, he made a few very bad choices. Yeah. In the shidduch of the question of who is the kala of the thing, the chosen between Hashem and the Jewish people, the chosen was Hashem. We in that position are the kala, the Jewish people. When we come to Shabbos, for instance, we say lechodaydi lekras kala. In that, the chosen, the groom, is the Jewish people, and Shabbos is the kala. But we call Hashem, our beloved, l'cho doidi, this is lacrosse, we call Hashem to come, this is with us, to greet the kala, as the bride, is Hashem, you know, the Shabbos. But really, in the Torah, really, it comes Hashem is the chosen, we are the kala. Right, right.
And yet, you had made the point that the fact that there was sometimes two didn't lead to led to an unstable period in the sense that they weren't.
Well, you didn't have a unity of decision making.
So there wasn't during the period of Rav Shmuel.
In that period, you did not have that.
Second question is, what is the basic source of all this?
You ask me about the source of the history of Rishur Agon. Some of it is actually culled from the pages of the Talmud. When you see, he points to this, points in various citations of the Talmud, and others are really from the history that was kept by the Gaonim. They wrote a history. It was actually they kept, you know, they. He was the almost next to the last. His son Rav Haigon, who Parsha seems was responsible for composing this letter, was the last. And they had documentation that was kept by the Gaonim also of the early history. So really, they had both.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.